Money is down. Food is up. Riots are happening. And so today we ask, what happened to cheap food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 585th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way over there in Sasebo who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hello, Michael.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phone.
Hello,
hello. Carol.
Hello.
Harmley Taff is out on special assignment. Kelsey Olson's at school. Folks, for decades, we enjoyed the good life of cheap food. In fact, our farmers grew so much food, we paid them billions of dollars to grow no more food. But then the price of food went through the roof, and the news from the world's food chain is not so good. The price of wheat increased 300% in the past 3 years. Stockpiles of rice are at the lowest in 25 years, while demand for the grain is up over 40%. The World Bank estimates 33 countries around the world face potential political and social unrest because of the acute hike in food and energy prices. There are food riots in Morocco, Senegal, and Cameroon, and 4 people are killed fighting for flour in Egypt. And so today we ask, what happened to cheap food? Here to help us explore the question, we have Paul Ellerick, an international food broker. Paul, welcome to the Food Chain.
Good morning, Michael. Thank you.
Pleasure to have you aboard today. I met Paul last week after the Food Chain. I was running around the farmer's market, and I met him having a conversation with one of the farmers there, and of course I somehow jumped into the conversation and learned that Paul was an international food broker, and he was telling some amazing stories of what it's like to be out there in the along the world's food chain buying and selling food and what's going on out there. So I thought it perfect opportunity to bring him in so that we can have a glimpse of what's going on out there in the world's food chain. But first, I'd like to ask Paul, what on earth is an international food broker doing hanging around the farmers' markets?
Well, I'd like to say I was out there trying to get some good ideas to take offshore, but that's not the case. I've got some friends that have been involved with the farmers' market for years. One in particular is Dave Peterson at the Corralitos Market. Mm-hmm. And another one, Tate Edwards, who's from Hollister and brings his plants over there.
So you have a connection with the farmers' markets then?
Yeah, I'll be a small one, yes.
Uh-huh. So, and also fun place to hang around, meet people.
It's fun. People from Santa Cruz are inviting, and it's always fun to watch the crowds.
Yeah. So you travel around the world. Tell us a little bit about your job, what you do in the world of food.
Well, let me clarify one thing. As a broker, I'm really more of an agent.
Okay.
I'm not really buying and selling goods. What I've done in the last 6 years is basically take my career up to that point and expand on a service for offshore manufacturers.
Okay.
Specifically in the food business and specifically in frozen vegetables and fruits. It takes me to places like South America and Peru and Ecuador, Guatemala, Mexico. And basically, I work as an independent representative for many of these companies that want to find a market for their products in the United States, whether it be in a retail market format, a restaurant format, or in bulk industrial sales.
And 30% of the fruits and vegetables now sold in the United States come from offshore.
Well, that's the aggregate number. I can tell you, just in terms of our area here in California, in terms of pounds, at one time, 400 million pounds of production of frozen broccoli was produced in California. That's all gone. I mean, it's all being manufactured offshore, primarily in Mexico, Guatemala, and now also Ecuador.
Is this a trend that you see accelerating in other fruits and vegetables? What happened to broccoli? Is it happening in other
It's an interesting question.
Well,
I think looking at the types of products that are grown overseas and that are exported into the United States, the predominant volumes are in the Midwest items. We call it the peas and the corn and things like that that we're seeing so much price pressure on right now. I would say yes, in some respects, the products that we find in the grocery store more and more are coming from offshore sources.
Okay, good. Well, good or bad. And it's easier to grow things offshore, isn't it?
Well, some people say it's easier. There's some climatology effects. You know, you've got the counter cycle seasons, as an example, in
right.
Peru.
Which is to say, when it's winter here, it's summer there, right?
Right, right. Okay. And Peru is even actually unique in the standpoint that they grow asparagus for the fresh market and processed goods 11 months of the year. Whereas, you know, in the United States, we have the Northwest that's in for the summer months. Michigan, it's in for about 2 months. And then California, which is another month and a half. And everything else is kind of bouncing between Mexico and South America.
So Peru has asparagus all the time.
Year-round. I'll say year-round for the most part. There's a couple of lag times, but...
Mm-hmm. Now, when you're out there on the food chain buying or helping people buy and sell, I should say, tell us a little bit about what's happening with the dollar.
Well, the most important thing that I've seen just recently, and when I say recently, within the last 6 or 8 months, is that we've never really been affected by having to compete with other regions for sourcing or for sales. Europe with the euro at
which
a dollar,
is to say, America was the market
absolutely.
Of choice for everybody.
Everyone wanted that U.S. dollar, and it's still the same case today. But we're competing more now for product, if you would.
Mm-hmm.
With the Europeans that are willing to pay more because their dollar or the euro is so at $1.57, I think it is today, much stronger than the U.S. dollar. The U.S. dollar is an example. The weakening of the dollar has required us as importers to pay more for the goods just so that the companies that I'm working with, in fact, can get the same value that they had a year before. Case in point, the Nuevo Sol, which is the currency in Peru, has basically dropped 14% to 15% just since November of 2007, and the trend is continuing. And by doing that, you know, it's obviously takes more dollars to get converted into Nuevo Sols. So we've taken increases on pricing, and it's something that our consumers on the industrial side have basically accepted.
Because
there's no other option.
We have no choice.
We've done a nice job of convincing folks that, you know, the facilities are a number one standard facilities. The growing conditions are perfect. The products are outstanding, and basically gave them a great value 3 or 4 years ago. Now they've got to catch up with just the reality of a flat globe, so to speak, when we're trading with people across all aspects of the economy.
Mm-hmm. So we, in a sense, are competing now.
That's true, and I think the more we compete, the more we're going to realize that the food costs, whether it's vegetables or other commodities, the food costs are escalating, and I see that trend not going away for a long time.
And do people still accept the dollar?
Oh, yeah.
Or is there...
As a matter of fact, you know, what's ironic is that if you were to look at the Internet and go to Yahoo and just try to look at the conversion factors... The Guatemalan quetzal is still pegged at the same value it had a year ago. So, you know, we're not dealing with the same issues in every country. The Peruvian market is all export for the most part. There is no internal consumers that buy the kind of vegetables that we buy out of Peru.
Lima doesn't buy it.
No, there's nobody consuming frozen asparagus in Lima or canned asparagus in Lima for the most part. And that goes for a lot of different commodities. And yet there's 75 microclimates in Peru that would grow just about any commodity at any time or any product.
That's on the west side?
Yes.
On the Andes?
Mm-hmm. Yep, on the west side. And actually, there's the fertilest area, the most fertile ground that we work with is about 3 hours south of Lima.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the Ica Valley.
So that's kind of a temperate climate.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the water conditions are such that, you know, everything's groundwater. Or there's no surface water that's used for agriculture in that area.
It's a dry
it's basically walking into it's walking into a sand desert. And then the further you go east, the more you've got water coming in from the aquifers under the ground.
Okay, so what happened to cheap food?
That's a good point. I think cheap food exists, had existed for a long time, and it was a matter of time before people had to realize that we were really being, whether it was subsidized or the farmers just weren't getting the returns.
Stay tuned, we'll be right back.
this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Hey, we're back, and my voice is back, I think. Today we're looking for what happened to our cheap food. It used to be that we prided ourselves in being the land of cheap food, and we were told to always be appreciative of cheap food. And so today we're trying to figure out what happened to that cheap food, because the prices of all food are going through the roof. With us today we have Paul Elric. If you're not a broker, what are you?
I'm an agent.
An agent.
Sales agent.
International sales agent. Paul travels around quite a bit along the world's food chain, helping people buy and sell food commodities. And so we're bringing him in today so that we can have a look and see, you know, what's going on out there in the world. Paul, you know, it used to be that people, you know, we took great pride in being the country of cheap food. But was that food really cheap?
No. My personal opinion is no. Whether it was accessibility to the water on the West Coast here, you know, to grow grapes in the San Joaquin Valley. No, there was a subsidies, whether it was in the water, the inputs, cash crops such as corn, peas.
Labor.
You know, the labor subsidy, you know, I don't know if that's something you can really subsidize. It was available, so it was exploited. But the bottom line is that as food costs have escalated just because of this, as an example, the ethanol craze in the last 2 years, you know, commodities like frozen corn traded in the 30s, I say the 30-cent range as an example, they're striking prices for new contracts in the 50-cent, 55-cent range now. And that's for the same quality product, the same, you know,
right.
That's almost 100% increase.
So everything's going way up.
Way up.
Real
way
fast.
Up. Yeah, and consumers are kind of having to bite the bullet. Not only in terms of what they're paying at the market, but also looking at what their options are for different vegetables.
Well, let's look at some of the reasons why cheap food disappeared. We have some information from the Federal Reserve Bank, Kansas City, the Main Street Economist. Reason number one, a growing middle class in Latin America and Asia. You run around Latin America a lot. Are people buying food down there?
Oh, absolutely, but you know, I think Latin America is still an exporting region. There's a lot of exports that come out of Central America, with Mexico, Honduras, Guatemala. What's not mentioned here is India. There's a middle class growing throughout the world, in my opinion, and what I'm reading about, and I think that's what's placing the additional pressure on availability of food products.
Mm-hmm. And these populations are not only eating more calories, but they're really going for the protein.
The proteins. There's an example in an article out of the South Carolina newspaper last week about consumers in middle-class China that they used to look at pork and beef as being a premium item that was kind of something you had on an occasional basis. And now it's like any place else, you know. If you can get it and it's available and you can pay for it, you're going to eat more of it, so...
And it used to be that they lived a lot on carbohydrates, right?
Right, right.
And a little bit of protein, and now they're becoming more like us, asking for more protein, and of course that puts a greater pressure on the food supply, right?
Absolutely. You start growing, you know, more cattle, more pork, more protein-type ingredients require grains for feed. The grain prices are reflected in the demand. I see that as a trend that's not going to go away either.
Okay, well, because the more wealthy they become, the more protein they want.
They've got discretionary income to spend on food products. As you said before, the carbohydrate-based diet can now be enhanced with more and more of the proteins and other items.
Okay, good. So there's one cause. What about number two? They say a drought in Australia in 2006 and 2007. It's hard for us to imagine just how severe that drought was, but it was terrifying.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's affected a lot of folks here in the West Coast that are producers of rice, as an example. I met with six or eight growers 3 weeks ago up in Chico who are growing paddy rice, and one of the things they are really keen to is as a commodity is the value of the product out of Australia. This recurring drought has placed a lot of demand on consumers from the Asian market looking for rice out of California, which historically hasn't been their mainstay.
Well, and also one reads that a lot of the main rice-producing countries are starting to withhold their exports for domestic consumption.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And thus putting even more pressure on it. So what's happening with the value of rice here in California? Is it going through the roof like everything else?
Well, I'm not an expert in the rice market, but what I did find out is that the paddy rice market is flat in terms of what the growers are returning. The mills basically coordinate and control, if you will, the pricing on the market. I think the mills are doing better than the growers are, unfortunately.
Usually the way it is, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Most of the money, 80% of the food dollar comes after food leaves the farm.
Right, and that's what I find is kind of a tragedy. The experts that make all this money on the in-betweens, I guess, if you will, are taking very little risk in relation to what the farmers are. The farmers are putting their assets up for collection if they don't come through with their payments. They've got the big nut at the end of the year after they take out loans to grow. And that's another reason why, as an individual agent, I'm working without the infrastructure of, you know, office space and New York City clientele.
Right. Number three, low worldwide wheat prices. This is a kind of an interesting one, kind of hard to grasp, because the last several years, wheat hasn't been worth very much, so farmers have planted less and less wheat. And the short-term holding of wheat, the storage has gone way down, and then all of a sudden there's a real demand for it, and it just isn't there.
Well, and that's something that's, if you look at the commodities like wheat and rice, they are truly a globally traded commodity. And the availability or the lack of surplus swinging 3%, 5% will have an impact globally. And I don't see that changing either. I think the traders of the world, whether they're trading from Enron's perspective or anyplace else, realize that you can really make a ton of money manipulating a market.
Mm-hmm. And can. And it's possible to manipulate those markets.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, number four, regional pests, diseases, freezes, droughts, floods, and other natural disasters. I guess it really speaks to what you're talking about, how the farmer is the one with everything at risk, because they are the one who are subject to all of these things.
Absolutely.
Taking over their farm and stealing their crops.
Well, not only that, and I think people are really sensitive now to what's being put on products, whether it's a fungicide or an herbicide, and I think that has a lot to do with the trend towards organics.
Yeah, we've got that down number eight here, so we'll pick that one up. Let's talk about increases in labor costs, and I guess that's something that we really see here in California, where the cost of labor really are going through the roof. And, you know, why I guess California agriculture has for so long relied on essentially illegal immigrant labor.
Mm-hmm. Transient. I mean, a lot of people throw the word illegal in front of them. There was the Bracero program years ago that seemed to have that kind of started the whole process of bringing temporary employees in or employee workers into the fields, but then they were going back someplace. I think now we've got an issue with lack of trained labor to try to match up with some of the processing skills that are now on the way. They've left. We've lost so many frozen food companies in the last 5 years. When I say lost, that have just decided to check out of California.
Why have we lost so many? I mean, is it simply because of the cost of labor are so less expensive in Mexico and in South America?
If you went back, I think 25 years ago that was the case. That, you know, the people from UC Santa Cruz will probably have better figures than I do, but I think at one time, you know, wages in Mexico are at the $3 a day range versus $7 an hour. I'm going back to the mid-80s.
Right.
But it's more than that. I don't think it's just the wage rate. I think it's also the workman's comp issues.
Ah, insurance?
Insurance for the
also,
manufacturers.
Also, what about environmental concerns?
Well,
we'll pick that up when we get back. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Paul Ellerich, international food agent, travels the world helping people buy and sell food. Today we're in search of cheap food. Whatever happened to our cheap food? It just disappeared. Curious to know what you have. If you have any insights into the situation, pick up your phone, give us a call. Phone numbers today, 800-624-2665. 831-479-1080. Pick up your phones and join us. Again, the phone number is 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Right back with Paul Ellerich, Michael Olson on The Food Chain. So what happened to cheap food? Prices are going through the roof. The value of the dollar is collapsing. People are rioting out there in the world. Four people were recently killed in Egypt fighting over flour. What on earth is happening? We're figuring that out with Paul Ellerich, who's an international agent of foods. He helps people buy and sell around the world, travels extensively throughout Central and South America. And so we're going through the list of what's going on with our foods and curious to know what you have to say, too. Pick up your phones and join us today. We're at 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. And, of course, Paul, one of the big ones that everybody's immediately aware of is the increase in fuel costs. Holy smokes, we all live on petroleum, don't we?
Absolutely.
And it's hard to comprehend just how much our modern production technologies are based on petroleum. You know, they talk about the Green Revolution and how the use of synthetic fertilizers and whatnot have really helped boost productivity around the world, but it's oil's in everything.
Petroleum-based fertilizers have doubled at least in the last year, and they continue to escalate. I don't know any farm operation that isn't using some type of fertilizer, whether it's organic or otherwise. The benefits from the fertilizer are obvious when you see yields enhanced. The packaging that we all take our products home from the grocery store is either chipboard or, in most of the cases, it's a poly bag or polyethylene package. So again, all the bags and packages in the produce section or in the freezer section are somehow related to petroleum.
And it takes essentially a lot of petroleum to pump water out of the ground or pump it into the fields. It takes petroleum to get workers from their homes into the field. It takes petroleum to plow the fields and make them ready for the planting. It takes petroleum to run the harvesting machines. It takes petroleum to get the crops out of the ground and into the processing facilities of the nation. And it takes petroleum to get it food from where it's grown to where it's consumed. They say the average food now travels a couple thousand miles from where it's grown to where it's consumed. Right. That's a long way.
That's an awful long way. I can give you a case in point. When you're buying Chilean fruit, whether it's fresh or frozen, it's cheaper to send Chilean fruit via a shipping container on a steamship to New York than it is to ship from California to New York on a refrigerated truck. Just, again, reflecting the cost mm-hmm. of diesel. And
so kind of the same phenomenon could be held true in China, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's cheaper to ship something across the oceans in a big ship mm-hmm. than across the country in a truck, right?
Absolutely. And, it's interesting because the Chinese, I don't know what the percentage is, and I'm sure someone does, but the amount of products that we consume from China, whether it's food-related or otherwise, is phenomenal. And what we don't recognize is that all these containers that end up here have an option to go back to China with something on them. And you'll find it's cheaper for them to leave their containers up in the Northwest than to try to ship back empty containers to China. So there's just a tremendous flood of goods from the Far East.
And thus our balance of trade goes through the roof because we're buying much more than we're selling.
That's the fallacy. Realistically, if we had any industry left in California or in the United States that was producing food products that we could export and take advantage of the weakening dollar, we would all benefit, I think. But there really isn't much left.
There isn't much left that we can make.
No, we're importing just about a high percentage of all our food products, at least.
So, hypothetical, what happens to a business that buys more than it sells?
Not going to be in business for long. I mean, it's, again, like the economy of the United States. We've got to have a balance, and you've got to be able to make some... You've got to make some room.
Got to make a profit someplace where you don't live.
Sure.
So, fuel costs are part of everything that we eat. And the more fuel that we use to get that food out of the ground and into our tummies, the more the food's going to cost. And that's as simple as that. There it is. Personal choices, you brought up this earlier. We have a way of wanting... better food than sometimes is offered at the most cheap rates, right?
Correct.
Sometimes we want organic as opposed to those foods that are grown in giant fields.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes that food costs more. And I guess milk would be a good example. You buy some organic milk and it costs, what, twice as much as regular milk.
Right.
And that has a substantial way of driving up food costs. And that's something that we're doing a lot of here in the United States is demanding higher quality foods.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something you see elsewhere when you're traveling around? Is that a concern anywhere else other than the United States?
Referencing the organics or just higher quality?
Just higher quality, but organics as well.
I think organics, it's an interesting situation. I mean, Americans have really embraced the organic farms and the organic product options. I know the UK, 4 years ago, there was a big push for one of the large retail chains, I think it was Sainsbury or someone, to convert all their market options, all the food products they could, to an organic food product.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were scouring the United States and the Pacific Northwest in particular, looking for suppliers, and there really wasn't enough ground that had been certified for organic production yet to satisfy that kind of demand. And it really, as a percentage of the overall consumption, it's probably still less than 5% or 8% of demand for staple
which
products.
Which would show considerable growth because of
absolutely.
A couple of years ago it was 2%.
Sure.
And yeah, that's a huge growth. So that has a way of driving up prices significantly as well.
I had a phone call 2 days ago from an ex-buyer that I used to work with who's now consulting on her own. And she won't tell me the name of the retailer, but it's a substantial retailer looking for organic frozen vegetables. But I had to respond by tomorrow or Thursday night, which was yesterday. I said, well, great. You call me 24 hours and you want to have, you know, $17 million worth of organic vegetables uh-huh. put on your lap. That's not going to work.
Where would you get that kind of organic production? Or can you?
Well, it's interesting. I think it's available in certain regions. I know up in the Northwest, Washington State in particular, along that Columbia River Basin, you can grow corn and peas on organic ground because there is ground available to put in production. And that's been going on now for about a decade. But as far as commercializing volumes that people are used to seeing in the, you know, on the frozen food shelf, it's still a niche market, and I mm-hmm. think demand is going to outstrip supply for a while.
Do you see people growing organically offshore?
No. As a matter of fact, that's one thing that's requested frequently from me is to find organic asparagus, frozen asparagus.
Mm-hmm.
And although organic asparagus probably exists in some areas in California on small, very small plots of land. The size of the ranch, the ranches in Peru is, you know, 700 acres at a time. Or
wow, huge!
Yeah, it's all drip irrigated. It's minimally processed with herbicides and fungicides, but you still need to have some kind of a input.
Well, let's go to the phones. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're at 800-624-2665. Oops. We'll go to the phones when we get back from this break. And we're going to talk about NAFTA and why organic is more expensive than others. We're with Paul Ellerich, International Food Agent, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're wondering what happened to cheap food. It used to be that we had cheap food, but today it's not cheap at all. And it's going to get more expensive and more expensive and more expensive as we go along. Or so says just about everyone. Right back, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Paul Ellerich. We're talking about what happened to the price of cheap food. It's gone through the roof. We're wondering why. So we're going to go to the phones right now and invite you to join us. 800-624-2665, 831-4-7-1980. And here's Rick, who wants to talk a little bit about NAFTA.
Yeah, good morning. I was curious what he has to say on NAFTA, CAFTA, and the new Colombian trade deal that Bush is trying to push through, how that affects all these commodity prices and between these various countries. Because we always seem to get the lower end of the deal on these trade deals.
Why do we get the lower end of the deal?
Yeah.
Why? Asking you, Rich.
Yeah. Well, all of our manufacturing seems to be going offshore, and we're buying everything. I was in one of the stores the other day, and everything I picked up said made in China. It used to be made in other places, but now China seems to be the predominant thing.
Well, Paul, this is what we were talking about.
I was wondering how that affects the foods, too.
Yeah, this is what we're talking about. I was just asking Paul what he sees as the outlook for an American agriculture, and we are the high-cost producer, it seems, of just about everything.
Well, the alternative use for land, as an example, is one of the things that drove a lot of the companies to other parts of the world for sourcing. To answer your question specifically about NAFTA or CAFTA or the Colombian Free Trade Agreement, you know, I see those all as positives. I know from a political perspective, other people have different opinions. The fact is, you know, we've got consumers that demand food products, and they, you know, we've been insulated for a long time by the virtues of working with other evolving economies to market goods in the United States, where people aren't having to, you know, pay $2 a pound for broccoli, as an example.
So these countries are able to provide us with food much cheaper than we could provide it ourselves.
And maybe it's not just so much as a cheaper. We've got a year-round supply now, as an example. When you look at South America and North America, you got the hemispherical differences between winter and summer.
Mm-hmm.
We all love to go in and find our peaches and apricots in February that are coming from Chile. And although we're paying a tremendous amount of money for them, it's still nice to have that option.
Well. Rich, got a follow-up?
So are we losing agricultural production in this country because it's cheaper to buy this stuff?
I think agricultural production in this company is going to follow what the multinationals, if you will, decide to do with what the ingredients. As an example, if you look at a Unilever, which is a very well-known huge corporation, they're coming out to the market on the retail side with ingredients from all over the world that go into these packaged food products. And consumers enjoy the convenience, they enjoy the quality, but if you look at the side of the bag and you find out where some of these ingredients are from, you might question, why can't we get this all from the United States? Well, the fact is, you probably could, but when it's all said and done, you couldn't afford to buy the meal for three people for less than $12, $15 maybe.
So we're becoming a country of just consumers and not producing anything.
Which is what we were asking earlier. What happens to a business when it buys more than it sells?
And then when we talked about China, we're talking about goods that come in here that end up not being very good. In some cases, killing animals or hurting people.
Right.
I mean, we don't have any control over the sources of how these products are being produced.
Well, I've not personally visited China, but I've worked closely with some associates from South America that are selling product from China into the UK and to Spain. And they've taken the similar standards with the facilities that they work with as their own. You know, they're working with the highest quality, the best managed, the most traceability that they can. I think just in the last year, though, you mentioned the bad press from China. I know that there's public companies, including Trader Joe's here on the West Coast, that they won't buy from China unless it's an ingredient. I happened to work last year on a very large deal with a major restaurant chain that got to the 11th hour, and they pulled out because one of our proposals was to get them the continuity of supply year-round and the volumes they wanted. We had to come from China with some of it. And they just, you know, 60 Minutes did a good job. As other, newspaper articles about the seriousness of the problem in China. And so we lost that deal altogether, and I think it was probably smart.
Rich, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
You bet. Moving on, let's talk with Tony. Tony, welcome to the food chain.
Good morning. I wanted to know why organics are more expensive in the stores than your non-organic foods, because I've always thought if you're using non-organics, you've cut some of your costs because you're not buying the chemicals or the fertilizer to treat the stuff with. So What other reasons are there that organics would be more expensive?
Great question. I'm going to pick. I'm going to put you on the air so that you can hear us on the air. I think you're on the cell phone and it's kind of weak, so listen to us on the air.
I'll take my answer on the radio.
Okay, thank you very much, Tony. Well, that's a great question. Why are organics more expensive than conventionally produced farm products? Because organics, after all, don't have to buy the chemical inputs.
Well, there's probably a number of different issues that go into your pricing scenarios for organics. On the fruit and vegetable side, I suspect that the ground that sits fallow for years and years before it qualifies for certification for organic ground has some impact on the value of the commodities. The amount of reduction in yield per acre that people typically except out of organics is also driving up the per pound basis pricing.
Also, what you mentioned earlier, demand is exceeding supply.
Sure, and there's a good marketing side to the whole story too. Mm-hmm. You know, the rule of thumb, a 25% increase over conventional is what you ought to expect to pay for organics.
Hey, when we get back, I want to ask you about this notion. Corporate profits, an excuse number 9 on this list. Kroger's fourth quarter 2000 sales were up 10% and profits but were up 18%. Kroger said that it paid 3% more for products. And they, in this quote, "In our view, periods of a moderate inflation is a positive for a business because inflation tends to improve sales." So the higher the costs, the more money they make. Huh. Right back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Paul Ellerich, International Food Agent. And you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We're back. This is The Food Chain. We're in search of cheap food, but it appears to be gone. And according to the World Bank, it may well be gone forever. The economists who look at these things say we appear to be entering a world of more expensive food, and it's not going to get cheaper. It's just going to get more expensive. And we're talking today with Paul Ellerich, who is a agent of International Foods. He helps people buy and sell around the world. And Paul, we're talking a little bit about what the future looks like for we who live here in the United States. We have this great tradition of cheap food, and yet as more and more of our food comes from offshore, it doesn't appear it's going to be cheap anymore. So we wonder what's going to happen with our domestic agriculture and how we're going to compete, be able to compete here in the United States with countries that can produce much for much less money than we can. You know, we around here live in houses that cost $500,000 and we're competing against people who live in the same houses their families have lived in for generations upon generations and don't have any costs and can get by on a couple of dollars a week where it costs us thousands. So how on earth can we, as the world's high-cost producer, compete with the rest of the world who don't have these costs? What's going to happen to us?
Well, I think this writing has been on the wall for a long time. If you just look at the amount of production that's been closed, the value-added processing of fruits and vegetables in the United States, it's been pretty basically shut down. The Pacific Northwest, I use this example often, Dayton, Washington produced all the canned asparagus that people typically would buy in the frozen grocery store or the grocery stores. That's all been closed and shut down, and it's all being produced in Peru. And Del Monte and Green Giant and all the private label products that are sold by other manufacturers or importers are basically all being produced in Peru now. Hundreds of jobs, if not thousands. Farmers left up in the Northwest with having to fight for other marketing alternatives for their asparagus.
So what's going to happen to farmers here in the United States? What's going to happen to our ability to produce our own food? How are we going to compete?
I guess the consumer is going to make that decision for them. If you're not willing to pay a higher price for food products that are produced in the United States, and you're willing to pay for a lower food products that are produced outside the U.S., that's kind of the answer in itself. The alternatives for growing food in the United States, if you're putting buildings up or strip malls or what have you, those are going by the wayside because of saturation. There's, you know, the value of building a housing tract over in Patterson, California doesn't make sense anymore. And they were trying to do that for a while as an alternative to growing different crops.
So, it doesn't look very good, does it, Paul Ellery?
Well, I don't know. You could say the flip side is, this is probably, if you're going to get into the production side of food, this is probably a good time to get in there.
And the best place to do it probably would be for the city, right?
Yes.
All right. Farmers markets, which is where I found you.
That's right. That's
hanging
right
around
right
the farmers market. So, folks, this has been the Food Chain. Sorry we're going to miss Rory, but we are out of time. But, hey, you can always join us on the web at metrofarm.com. Go to the forum page. Leave your comments and questions there. And be sure and stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio. But as we end here today, we always want to remind you that cheap food isn't, and never has that been more evident than it is today in today's news. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Paul Ellerick. It's been a pleasure having you aboard.
You're welcome, Michael. Thanks.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.